Welcome back to Integrative Lyme Solutions with Dr. Karlfeldt. I am so excited about the show that we have ahead of us. We have some phenomenal information that could save lives. I am Dr. Michael Karlfeldt, and with me I have my co-host,
Tanya Hobo.
You're going to need to tune in to what's going on today. The information is jam-packed, so don't step away.
So excited. Let's go ahead and get this started. Welcome to Integrative Lyme Solutions with Dr. Karlfeldt. And today we have another great guest, Miss Susan. She is, I believe, all the way from New York, right?
Baltimore.
Okay.
Close enough,
right? I knew somewhere over there on the East Coast. So we are so excited to have you with us, Susan. We've got more than just a Lyme journey to talk about. So thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
Well, I'm really excited to hear. I know you and Tanya chatted quite a bit, but I haven't had the opportunity to be part of those conversations. So So you both have dealt with Lyme, and you are doing a lot of things legislatively, or what are you? Tell me a little bit about what's going on.
Well, let me just say what a long, strange trip it's been. I started 15 years ago, did not intend to be a Lyme advocate or a lawyer when I started, but I got recruited by a tick. And that would send me on a journey. Actually, I was recruited as a child, but I didn't know it because I was misdiagnosed with Legionnaire's disease. So it would be decades before I would ever come to understand what had been going on in my body all of those decades. But, you know, when I first tripped upon my diagnosis, I actually bullied my way into my diagnosis because I tested negative 4 times, and the doctors kept telling me I didn't have a bullseye, so I couldn't have it. And, you know, all of the usual things that you hear. And so I finally went into an infectious disease doctor. At that point, I was so ill and I couldn't even speak. And I begged him for antibiotics. And he told me I didn't have Lyme disease, but he told me I was so hysterical that he was going to give me antibiotics. But he was going to test me first. And he called me on a Wednesday morning at 6:30 in the morning and told me I was off the charts. And he was an infectious disease doctor. So he handed me a barrel full of antibiotics and probenecid to pump up the volume of the antibiotics. And he told me, "You're a very sick woman." He said, "But I can't treat you," he said, "because my society would drum me out of their membership." He said, "So please take these drugs and never come back again." And that was how I finally tripped upon my diagnosis.
So here you've been tested negative 4 times, and then the 5th time you were off the chart. Is that what I was hearing?
Correct. And the times I tested negative, what happened was I'm a trial attorney. So I was in the middle of a trial and I had a seizure. And I lost my ability to retrieve language. I lost my ability to speak. So as I stood there in front of the judge going, he thought that I was unprepared. And he threw my exhibits at me and postponed the case. And I was postdictal, but I walked out of the courtroom and I had no recollection of what had just happened. And everybody kept asking me what happened. I thought they were talking about why the judge had reacted the way he did. But I drove home postdictal, passing out every few minutes along the way. And I lost, completely, my memory was completely wiped out. I would lay in bed twitching. I was all curled up in a ball and it hit my central nervous system like a sled. I mean, just knocked me on my tail. And I couldn't speak. And I would get to the bottom of my driveway. I couldn't remember what was left or what was right. So I would sit in my driveway crying. And I couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And I had this tremendous air hunger. I couldn't breathe. Couldn't make it from my bed to the bathroom. And I remember at one point, I said to my family, just either get me to the hospital or put a bullet in me, but I can't live like this. And so it would take me a number of, I guess it was about a month before I finally found this doctor. And I saw every doctor that you could see. And so when he called me at 6:30 in the morning, I jumped out of bed and I started dancing. And I went, I'm sick, I'm sick. I know what it is now. And I was so excited. And then I found out what it was.
So, you sound exactly like me. After 7 years, I was over the moon excited, calling everybody. Guess what? I have Lyme disease. Like, I was super excited about it. But I was excited that somebody believed me that something was wrong. And then when I found out what it was, I thought, oh, yeah, I don't want that. So, but it is exciting, right, when we get that diagnosis.
You think there's an answer, you know, you just, what you don't know is that there is no answer. Well, there are answers, but you have to find them. You don't know that the average mainstream physician has no idea what it is. I can't tell you how many people I speak to every week who clearly have Lyme disease and their doctors say, oh, it's a false positive. And I always say to that person, did they test you for lupus? Did they test you for HIV? Have they tested you for syphilis? And they go, no, why? And I go, because to assume something is a false positive means that you're cross-reacting with something. So for a doctor to conclude that it's a false positive without ruling out all the different things that it could cross-react with, to me, is malpractice, pure and simple. Okay, you believe it's a false positive, prove it. You know, rule out everything else. And I seldom see that happen. But
you know, just talking to you for a few minutes and you listing off all of your symptoms that you had. I mean, to me, hey, it's obvious it's Lyme disease, you know, and especially when you're dealing with a doctor. And like you said, okay, so if it's not Lyme disease, then what is it? Don't just give up and tell me I'm crazy and give me antidepressants, you know, and unfortunately that happens all too often.
And also, you know, like your doctor, infectious agent, I mean, that should be the one that deals with this issue. But here, because he is afraid then of getting kicked out of his little club, you know, then recognize and the lack of training for the other doctors in regards to what this is, because obviously, you know, there's going to be no medical society or medical group that will do this kind of training because it is not acknowledged in any way. And if they have then the threat of losing their license, getting kicked out of their club, then they're not going to want to pursue that type of education anyway.
Well, then you have people like me who have friends who go see doctors. You know, like, people will come to me all the time and they'll call me and they'll say, somebody told me to call you. And they start to tell me their symptoms. And when I see multi-systemic involvement with all kinds of different systems, when you got the GI system, you've got the neurological, you have brain fog, you've got joint pain. There's a reason. There's something driving that. And generally, it's going to be an underlying infection. And Lyme happens to be, you know, it's so prevalent that it happens to be a really good suspect. So when, and especially someone will tell me, you know, I had a bullseye rash years ago and I never got treated. So I'll say to them, go to your doctor, ask to be tested. And I give them, you know, Lyme and all the co-infections. And I had a friend not too long ago go to their doctor and say, would you please test me for this? Doctor says, you don't need it. You don't have it. Okay. So I wrote that doctor a letter and I said to the doctor, you know, on Susan R. Green, attorney at law letterhead, I said, you know, my friend asked you for a Lyme test. He presents with a history of a bullseye rash, multisystemic complaints that are all consistent with a clinical diagnosis of Lyme. You refused to test him. And I said, my estimation, I think that's malpractice. So the doctor wrote me back and she said, oh, he never complained about any of those things. I said, then you're willing to test him. Now she says, no, we don't have that here. Now, how can you be living in this day and time? I think we're sixth in the country. How can you be so completely obtuse? For me, like, if you ask most doctors, you say to them, how long was your course in Lyme disease in medical school? They'll say, well, I think it was 15 minutes. And, you know, I'll get into legislation in a minute, but one of the times that we brought a bill for long-term insurance for insurance for long-term antibiotics. And the chair of the department did not want to, I mean, of the committee did not want to put it through. So what she did instead was she gave us $100,000 for medical education for CME. And I went to the head of MedCAI here and I said, you know, they wanted to honor the patron of the bill. And she said, if you want to honor me, let me bring Susan Green down here and let her help with picking the physicians to teach this course. And so we were going to have a very balanced group of presenters on both sides of the issue. We were going to have IDSA doctors. We were going to have doctors who, you know, LLMDs and, you know, naturopaths, everything, the whole gamut. So we're waiting, and we never heard back. And then when we went back to session the next year, we said, you know, how come we've never heard back from you? And they said, oh, we already have a CME video on Lyme disease. The IDSA put one out and the CDC, and we already have it. And so they totally defeated the whole purpose of what we won, you know? So it never happened. But that's the perils that we battle all the time.
So how, talking about the legislative, I mean, I do actually want to hear, how did you get over Lyme? What did you do?
Okay.
I know, it's like, what do we talk about first? There's so much. But yeah, so you kind of mentioned a few of your symptoms. So let's kind of go over your, you know, once you got your diagnosis, what you went through, and then where you finally ended up getting your treatment and getting better.
Okay. So I could barely speak. When, I mean, I couldn't speak in sentences when it hit my brain. It hit my brain so badly. And I was starting to develop plaques on my brain. And the first thing that, so I went to these doctors, and in broken English, I said to them, listen, if you will just help me get back my ability to speak, I'm going to help you. I'm going to help with legislation. I'm going to defend you guys. Just, you have to get me back my ability to speak. And so I kind of got adopted by, you know, a lot of the ILADS doctors, all of whom really, really wanted to help me. They were, I mean, I saw the best of the best. And I went all over the country getting, you know, seeking treatment. And I had a wonderful doctor here, Ken Singleton. He's retired now, but he wrote the book, The Lyme Disease Solution. Fabulous doctor. And he was my quarterback. He, you know, would oversee all my testing and things like that. So they got me, you know, they would get me about 85% better, and then I'd relapse. And then they get me better, and then I'd relapse. And I did that for 13 years. In the meantime, during the course of those 13 years, I went on to start lecturing at ILADS, teaching the doctors how to safeguard their practices from medical boards and from other assorted and sundry vicious attackers. And I got to know everybody, but one of the doctors who I represented called me one night very late, well, actually early morning, and he was very distraught. And a young woman that I had sent him, she was in her 20s, he called me and he said, she's dying. I don't know how to save her. I think she's going to die. I almost had a heart attack because this was a very dear friend of mine's daughter. So I called them and I said, get on a plane and go to Switzerland. I had heard about a clinic in Switzerland, and it was one of the only places I had heard about where people got 100% better. And so I said, you have to take her. You have to take her now. They did. She got there and she did not want to get off her medications. She was, you know, she didn't want them to tell her what to do. She didn't want to get off her painkillers or sleep meds, all of that. So they said to her very candidly, in Switzerland, we can't help you. You know, to the extent you want to be your own doctor, we're really sorry, but we don't have anything to offer you. She came home. She went, oh my God, I screwed up. And she went back. So she went for 3 weeks. She got completely better. What they believe in Switzerland is, you know, unlike Western medicine, where they treat symptoms, you go in, you say, oh, I have a stomach problem. You know, I'm having trouble with this or that. And they give you a medication to fix that. And it fixes that. But then it breaks this. All of a sudden, you're having this other problem. So they give you something to treat that symptom. And that works. But then there's another symptom and another symptom. And so 17 medications later, your gut biome is all screwed up. Everything is a disaster. And now you're just treating symptoms, and it can turn into such a, you're chasing your tail, basically. So in Switzerland, they believe that the immune system has everything it needs to fight off infection if it's functioning properly. And what they do is they do erythropoiesis, which is they clean your blood. They treat you with DMSO, which is an IV that opens your cells to help allow your cells to rid themselves of the toxins, the heavy metals, the environmental pollutants, the plastics, the adjuvants from your childhood vaccines. And they start chelating you to try to get all that junk out of you, while at the same time working on your gut biome to try to reboot your gut. And they do fever therapy. They do irotherms, so they induce fevers, and ozone. So they have all these modalities that regrettably are not FDA approved here, so we don't have easy access to them here. But she got completely well. This was a girl that was dying, and she now has two children. She's completely healthy and completely off medications. So her mother saw me out one day, and she said to me, "Susan, I don't understand. You made us take our daughter to Switzerland. Why haven't you gone?" I was like, "Well, I'm taking care of my mother, my father, I've got a son, my dog." I had 100 excuses. And she said, "Just go." And I went, "Oh." So I did. And it was like so totally out of the realm of consideration for me, because I'm not the person that gets on a plane and jets off to Switzerland, for my treatment. I have a law practice, I have a family, I have things that I'm responsible for. But I did it. I just took a leap of faith. And sure enough, I got there and they said to me, "We're going to take you off, your Mallarone." I said, "You can't do that. I have air hunger. I won't be able to breathe." And they said, "You can't breathe, but not for that reason." And they said, "Just trust us." They said, "We know who you are. We know you come in here and you tell us you're a Lymie." And they said, "You come in here and we know that you're the Lyme warrior. We've heard about you all the way over here. We know you taught 800 doctors in Paris." They said, "We know who you are." But they said, "If you're ever going to get better, you have to stop identifying yourself as a disease." They said, "We need you to start being a person who had an illness and is now in recovery, as opposed to defining yourself as this disease." They made me quit my, I was working, I was legislative counsel for Nat Cap Lyme. They said, "It's time to let that go. There are other people to carry the torch. We're going to focus on you getting well." And I stayed there for 3 weeks. Came home off all the medications, and I just get better, better, better all the time. And I'm completely restored. I'm very, very fortunate, very blessed.
So
So.
what kind of therapies? I mean, you mentioned erythropoiesis and the DMSO. Yeah, were those the kind of the main and ozone probably? Were those the main things that you're doing?
At this point, well, I will say that I've been back to Switzerland. I go back every year. I'm like, they I just I love it there. I love the people. When I say I love it there, I don't mean Switzerland. I mean the clinic. I love the wellness aspect of it. I love, getting my immune system fine-tuned. So the first thing I did was I saw a dentist there. He is a biological dentist. He's an MD, he's a maxillofacial surgeon, a dentist, and he had three other degrees. So he said, "All of this, all of the ceramics and the metal in your teeth have to come out." And I said, "Well, can I see some photographs of your work?" And he said to me, "Susan," he says, "I have 6 degrees." And I said, "Well, Joseph, a rectal thermometer has 106 degrees, and you know where we put that." So, at any rate, he very humbly showed me his photographs. I let him do my teeth, and they reversed my what are they called? Root canals. So reversed my root canals. Took out every scrap of everything toxic in my mouth. DMSO started right away. They test everything. They test every fluid and every substance in your body, and they have these really wonderful labs that can tell you every lab result that is is it the least bit off? And then they go to they start fine-tuning your protocol. So they do dark field blood studies. I was able to see my cells and see that they were misshapen and clumpy and all kinds of other things. And not only they do a ton of detoxing, which is, I think, so important, but they also at the same time they're giving you organopeptides. They will do hydrocolonics, and at the same time they're giving you probiotics to restore the flora. There's a number of different modalities that they use, but I can only tell you that altogether, and they do neurals. They do a lot of neurals where they're injecting you with procaine in different trigger point areas or anywhere you've had an incision or anything like that. I can only tell you that I've said they came to Baltimore to do a lecture, and we filled the room, approximately 20, in excess of 20 people came the next day. They did free consultations, and those people all went to Switzerland. Every one of them was chronically ill. None of them could get well. They had all been taking antibiotics forever. They all went over there. They all got off medication, and they're all completely well today. So
That's awesome. 100 out
that's
of 100.
amazing.
Only one. There's only one that didn't get completely well. He got better. He's very, very neurologically compromised. When he got there, his arms would flail so badly that it would take two people to hold his arm down to give him an IV. When he left, he was able to hold his arm still to get the IV by himself. But unfortunately, he didn't get completely well because he's so severely compromised.
That's a huge success in itself. I mean, that's tremendous. Well, thank you. And so legislatively, I'm really fascinated in what are the kind of the immediate, obviously this is a field where it's so there's so much to do, there's so much to address, and we know the speed of legislation. It's not very fast. So what are kind of the things that you saw, this is what we need to tackle immediately, and what was the reception, and what's the impact, and how are we doing?
So I've taught a course at ILADS on the nuts and bolts of legislation. I teach it, periodically, and I'm always happy to help any advocacy group anywhere in the country. If they call me and they want to know how they do a legislative drive, I'm always happy to help. But I think people, so I learned the hard way. My first bill was a scorched earth approach. It was a kitchen sink. It had everything in it. And I thought, I'm a lawyer. I'm smart. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to fix this whole thing right now. And I just went in there, naively, marched in there like an imbecile. And I thought it should be easy. I just have to explain it to them. And of course, nothing's ever easy in Lyme land. The first problem I ran into were there were other advocates in the area who, I think that they need to add a diagnostic code to diagnosing Lyme. I think they should add the need to single-handedly solve the Lyme pandemic, because some of the advocates I ran into would kill your bill just to kill your bill because they didn't bring it. It was insane. The backbiting. I mean, it's just crazy.
Really?
Oh yeah, it was crazy. The backstabbing. It was nuts. But at any rate, so I learned very quickly. One of the most important things to a successful campaign is know what your ask is. Keep your ask simple. So when I went back to the drawing board, my first ask was the patient information disclosure bill. And basically all that bill said was that at point of service where the blood is drawn, that you have to hand out a sheet of paper to everybody that you test that says that the test for Lyme disease can issue false negatives, and that in the event you get a false negatives, but your negative, but your symptoms persist, return to your provider for further care or treatment. Okay. Simple. It like how you can have a test that's over 60% false negative and not tell the patient. They have it in this t they used to have it in very little print on the test, I mean on the results that would go to the doctors that even the doctors were unaware of. So we brought that in Virginia and Maryland and we got that passed. And I think one of the greatest joys of the campaign was that Johns Hopkins Hospital had to, they put out the letter on their letterhead and they had the patient sign it, which that was originally part of my bill, as I wanted the patient to sign it. I wanted it to be appended to their chart. The doctors didn't want that. They fought that. They said that it was too onerous. And I remember when I was at the HHS Tick-Borne Disease Working Group, I ran into Dr. Allwater, who is a Hopkins infectious disease doctor, who was so against this bill. I said, "Hey, doc." I said, "I'm so happy to see Johns Hopkins is having the patient sign the paper and you're appending it to the file." He goes, "Oh, it's a terrible law, terrible law." I said, "Doctor," I said, "you do realize that by taking that extra step, you're protecting yourself." I
Yes.
said, "That way, when the patient comes back 10 years later and says, 'You never told me that the test could be false negative,' you can pull it out and say, 'But of course I did. Here, you signed it.'" Right? I said, "That's for your protection, doctor." Ooh. So anyhow, they're slow learners, some of them. He's gonna blow up my portal tomorrow. I know he'll watch this thing. He's gonna blow up my portal. He always does.
But it makes sense. You want them to know that it's not reliable. And yes, exactly. You're having them sign it to cover your butt.
Of course. How
Yes.
many people do you know that are so horrifically ill that had they been told in the beginning that number one, you don't have to have a bullseye rash, and that number two, the test is over 60% false negative? Do you know how many people could have gotten a far superior outcome had they only known? And that's, it's just, there's no excuse for it. It's
There's
just
not.
bad medicine.
I did three tests and they were all negative. And nobody even, I didn't have a clue that it could be wrong. You know, you just think you get a blood test and whatever it says is true. So,
Right.
yeah, that saved me, that would have saved me a lot of years.
Exactly.
And
So that.
I think a lot of doctors actually just want you out of their office because they don't know what to do with you. They don't have, it's not an You're too time consuming in how they need to treat you. They'd rather just have somebody come in, 5 minutes, you're done, here's a pill, and out you go.
It's
Oh, I
either
always.
that or they have this thought of Lyme in their brain and they don't want to have anything to do with it.
Well,
It's either or, yeah.
it's been so terribly maligned. I saw down at a hospital, excuse me, near Annapolis, they had a scrolling one of those lighted message boards, and it said, "Need a Lyme test? You probably don't." Okay, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, that's the practice of medicine. If you're telling somebody they don't need a Lyme test, and you haven't taken a history and you haven't done an examination, you're practicing medicine, but you're not, that's malpractice. So anyhow, it seems to be my job. There's a group called, I think it's called Choosing Wisely, and I think it's a propaganda group. I think it's an umbrella organization that houses every discipline and insurance companies, et cetera, and so forth. And they believe that we're overtesting. And so they really do their best to discourage people from getting tests. I understand that the test is not reliable, but the bottom line is if you're a doctor and the medical board comes a calling and you're treating them for Lyme, you better have tested them. And then if they're negative, you better have put in your chart your clinical observations as to why you believe they have Lyme disease. You can't just not test them. So that was our first bill. And then the second bill I brought a few of them. I snuck one in Virginia that was going swimmingly. It was really going well until they finally figured out what I was talking about. But I brought a bill that basically said that if you are a patient and you, if you're a patient with Lyme disease and you elect long-term antibiotic care after a full and complete informed consent, if you so elect, and if a doctor is willing to provide that care and treatment, then the doctor cannot be brought under scrutiny or punished by a board for electing to do so. And we had couched it in such brilliant terms, if I must say so myself, that nobody understood what it meant. And it flew through the Senate and the House. We were just doing so great. And then we had a lobbyist that went to the head of the medical board to try to get his endorsement. And once they figured out what it meant, it was everything came screeching to a halt. So we didn't quite get that one over the fence. But we've also brought bills for to compel insurance coverage for long-term antibiotic care. And I think the most important thing, if I were going to speak to legislation, the most important thing is keep your ask simple. All right, pick one thing, keep it small. Go to your advocacy groups in the area, get a consensus. Make sure that you're all on the same page. Make sure that you pick a patron for your bill and that you have an understanding with that patron that in the event the bill goes south, that they'll kill it for you. Because once you give them the bill with the exact language that you want, it goes to the sausage grinder, you know, the drafting department, and they go to the IDSA, they go to the CDC and the health department. Now the bill is going to come back bearing no, you know, absolutely no likeness to the bill you submitted. Okay. And you can really get hurt. You cannot fall in love with your own bill so much so that you want to get it passed so badly that you pass a bad bill, because no bill's better than a bad bill. And people have a hard time sometimes. They've worked so hard and it looks like the bill will go through, but you got to be really careful with the language because you can really screw the pooch on that. So it's important to have a great patron who is fluent in the literature and will take the time to read it. And then you want to do consensus building with the other side, see how many people you can get on board and see what the objections are. See if you can work it out. If you want to do a legislative drive, I strongly recommend, it's going to take you generally at least 3 years. The one in Maryland went through first time unanimously, but you have to really, really work. You've got to get to know every senator, every delegate, walk the floors, tell them why it's important, leave literature. And you have to, you really have to plant the seeds before you are actually going to start the drive. And you need to get as many people involved as possible because they need to all call their delegates and their senators, and they need to make their presence known. The more people, I think, what did they tell me? I think if they get 12 or 13 inquiries about a bill, they open a file. Okay. So I used to get this software that used to bury them. I think, what did we do? Something like 1,200 letters with the software. All you had to do was fill out the body of it with your name and your address, and it would generate a letter to all your senators, all your delegates. I mean, so we just buried them 1 year in Virginia. It was a beautiful thing.
I love that.
What are the greatest challenges for people that are wanting to do this? You were talking about other organizations, lobbyists, that want to just backstab you because they didn't bring the bill forward, or is it the legislators or the medical? What are the greatest challenges that people should be aware of?
So the medical board, the CDC, the agencies, health departments, they all believe what they believe. And, you know, over the years, I have had many a dinner with Ben Beard and with, I can't think of his name, but the head of the vector-borne disease division of the CDC. They're lovely people. Lyle Peterson, lovely people. We always end up agreeing to disagree. So you have to know who your opponents are, and you have to know what their opposition is, okay? Again, get all of your advocacy groups in the area on board. Work together, draft the bill together, and go over it. And, you know, the more people that you have on your team, the better off it's going to be. Because I can tell you, A lot of people with Lyme disease, they really want to help, but they're so sick that at the end of the day, you're going to find that a lot of the volunteers can't show up. They can't. And I can tell you, I probably have calluses on my feet that will last a lifetime from walking the halls of all of these general assemblies, going from, from room to room to room to room, because there was nobody to show up at the end. And it's a terrible position to be in. So the more the merrier. Everybody have a consensus before you get started. When you start getting the drafts back, make sure your own people aren't going to kill the bill, it's daunting. The medical boards are they're a problem unto themselves because they, if you're a physician and you're treating with long-term antibiotics, what winds up happening is we tell all the physicians, somebody shows up, they have a lump. Okay. It's not part of Lyme. You've got to refer them to a specialist to rule out cancer. If you don't, it's malpractice. So you got to refer them to a specialist. You refer them to the specialist, they walk into the specialist. You've sent them. You would think they would at least pick up the phone if they have a question and call you. Nope. They say, "What kind of medication are you on?" Your patient tells them the medications they're on. Next thing you know, they're filing a complaint with the medical board, right? Or the insurance companies filing a complaint with the medical board. And, when the medical boards want you, they're going to do everything they can to get you. And my friend, my associate, Jacques Simon, and I, we defend a lot of licenses around the country for these doctors. I've been begging ILADS for years, come up with a panel of experts who will testify for the patients in malpractice cases, testify for the patients in Social Security disability cases, testify for the doctors when they get in trouble. Nobody will testify because everybody's busy keeping their head down, and rightfully so, because the medical boards are going to come after them if they suddenly become an expert on the subject. And so it's very difficult. It's very difficult to defend these cases. It's difficult to bring these cases. We don't have experts. We have them, but they can't talk.
Wow.
Yeah. So what? Because you're pushing these pieces of legislation then in different states. I mean, is it easier then to replicate what you have succeeded in one state and try to bring that into other states? Is that taking place right now, or how does that work?
Well, I always think, I believe if it isn't broken, don't fix it, right? If you're getting these bills passed in various states, work off of those as a model. And but again, know what your bill says, because if you don't, if I know of one bill that was passed in a state, and I won't mention the state because otherwise the person in that state will call me endlessly and torture me. But I was so excited to get a bill passed. Again, fell in love with the bill and with, getting it passed. Doesn't say anything. It basically neuters itself. And so it's completely ineffectual. They've got a Lyme bill in this particular state and everybody celebrated, but it doesn't say anything. Very important to know. I mean, analyzing a bill is tough work. It's really, you have to understand every nuance, because if there's a loophole, it'll be used.
So the challenge then with if you're then wanting to pass a second bill, then the legislators will point at the initial bill that doesn't say anything and say, well, we already got something. And then that will be an impedance, I would assume, for other bills further on.
Well, again, if you're in a different state than the state that brought the bill that doesn't say anything, and you say, "Hey, I'm going to go bring a bill. Hey, this one passed in this state, and it passed really easily." Well, it passed really easily because it doesn't do anything. So if you're going to go to all the trouble to do a legislative drive, I mean, you're talking about, you've got to have constituents who are donating to their representatives. You've got a lot of investment in time and energy, and it's hard work, so if you're going to do it, make sure you're getting something that's meaningful and that's really going to benefit your state. So people come to me, everybody wants coverage for long-term antibiotics. And that's one of the hardest ones to get. It's been done in a number of states. It's getting easier as more and more. I always said that legislation will become easier because we've got the ticks working for us. I remember when I started 15 years ago, I remember being thrown out of the office. There was a delegate, and he was an emergency room physician. And he basically threw me out of his office and told me Lyme wasn't a problem. And he was laughing at me. He was very rude. And I went back every year, every year. And then the CDC changed its statistics from 30,000 cases a year to 330,000 cases a year. And I sent it to him. And I sent him the article about the Red Cross, the blood banks being tainted with Babesia. And I said, "Hey, doc," I said, "you're familiar with all this, right?" And he read it and he wrote me back. He said, "No, I didn't know any of this." And I said, "Well," I said, "I guess it's a problem now." And he said, "It really is." So I went from being unceremoniously thrown out of his office to he calls me the Lyme Czar, you know? And we brought a bill one time. This is an example of how good bills can go bad. We brought a bill to have May designated Lyme Awareness Month. Okay. What could possibly be wrong with that? Okay. So we'd had the governor give us proclamations making, May Lyme Awareness Month. We bring the bill, and he comes running out and he says to me, "Hey, Susie, I've got great news for you." I was like, "What's that?" He says, "Your bill's going to pass." He says, "We're going to give you a Lyme Awareness Day in May." I said, "A what?" He says, "A day." So I don't want a day. And he goes, "Well, no." He says, "We can't give you a month because then every disease will be in here. Everybody's going to want a month. There's only so many months." I'm like, no. But listen, I said, "May for Lyme, it's so important." I said, "May is important because this is when people start going outside again. This is when people start venturing out into the woods. It's a reminder, it's a public service announcement. And that's why May is such an important month to Lyme." I said, "Some of these other diseases, God bless them, they all deserve their own month, but there's no correlation between the disease and an actual month." And I said to him, "You can't give me a day because I've already got a proclamation from the governor for a month." And he goes, "Well, that's what we're going to give you. We're going to give you a day." I went back to my patron and said, "Kill the bill. I don't want a day. I want a month." Right? And that's how, it's the smallest little thing, but why take away 29 other days that I have in my proclamation? Right? So anyhow, it's a tremendous amount of work, but if you're going to do it, do it smart. We can tell you how to do it. There's an easy formula. And I had a call recently from another state, from a young man who's so wanting to do something, so wanting to make a change. And God bless him. I really admire him for that. He really wants to help. But he's being shuffled around, go talk to the health department. The health department's going to talk to him and it's going to say, "Very nice. Thank you for coming in. But by the way, we follow the CDC." And he'll be out on his ear, in no time. I said, "Go get a patron, go get a senator, go get a delegate to go with you, because they'll listen to the senator or the delegate. They're not going to listen to you." And people come to me, they ask me for my help, and then tell me why I'm wrong. I respect that. I can be wrong. I'm certainly, I'm not the last word on Lyme, and I don't know everything. I just know what's worked for me. And so we try to help wherever we can.
So kind of the formula, from what understanding, I mean, first you obviously you get a consensus among all the different associations within the state, and then you find a patron, that's willing then to work for you, a legislator, whether it's on the House, on the Senate side. Obviously, the more powerful and more seasoned, the better. And then you then draft a bill, and then it gets rewritten, and then you track that, and you make sure that the patron is powerful enough to kill the bill if you need to kill the bill. Is what am I missing in that process?
And you make it sound so easy.
First of all, I would tell you before you even present the bill, get every association, like we have a number of different advocacy groups in Maryland, get them all together, okay, so that everybody's on board. Get let them all look at the language, let them all put their two cents in, get it exactly the way you want it, because it's going to be the best it's ever going to be when it leaves your hand and goes in the hand of that patron, okay? I would want somebody on both the Senate and the House side. You want patrons on both sides. And then after you get those patrons, you get sponsors. So you take the bill around and you talk to all the people in the Senate and the House and say, you know, would you please sponsor my bill? And you get them all to sign on. Okay. So we got a lot of people to sign on. Then you send it, you send it up for drafting. It's going to come back, like I said, bearing no response, no resemblance to what you filed. And so then you have to go over it with a fine tooth comb and make sure they didn't shaft you somewhere and make sure it doesn't do something that's going to hurt your state. Now, I will tell you, in Virginia, one of the bills we had, it came back so many times rewritten. No matter what we sent up, it was like, how do I keep getting this thing back? That, like, it's the only other side. It's not at all what we're trying to bring. So we had a wonderful sponsor down there, patron, Senator Dick Black. Okay. God bless his little heart. There's something called, you can gray paper a bill, I think it's called. He walked in and what he did was he dropped the bill exactly as written. So in other words, he bypassed drafting and dropped it exactly as written. There's some risk with that because it may not dovetail with all the requirements of legislation, but ours did. And we managed to finally get it through the way we wanted it, you know? But that took a huge set for him to walk in and gray paper it, drop it as was. It's hard to get somebody to do that. As far as killing the bill, the person who is presenting the bill, they can always kill that their own bill. They can always withdraw it. You have to be careful. I had I guess he was a delegate then. Had a delegate once that had Lyme disease, you know, and I trusted him. So I said to him, listen, if this bill goes south, if they send it up to the meat grinding department and it comes back bad, you have to promise you're going to kill it. Promise. Okay. Really promise? I promise. I got together with one of the leading doctors on Lyme disease in Maryland. We worked for probably 2 hours over brunch, okay, getting it so that he could live with it and I could live with it. We then sent it in for drafting. It came back completely different. Instead of coming back to me, the constituent, and saying, you know, here's a copy of what came back, he went back to that doctor who now on his own had carte blanche to change everything that he didn't like that I put in back to what he wanted. Okay. So now I look at the bill, I almost had a heart attack because it was not helpful to us. It was going to hurt us. And I said to him, I said, okay, we got to kill this bill. I said, because this isn't what we wanted. It's not what we intended. So I need you to kill this bill. He says, I like it. I'm not killing it. And went out and did a press release on the bill that day. All right. I was having a nervous breakdown. I brought down the hounds of hell on him. I had constituents, huge constituents, calling him up and saying, I'm going to pull every bit of support I have from you. And he was like, I like the bill. I won't even tell you what it took for me to get the bill killed, but it was crazy, just crazy. And so that's why this is such it's a very dangerous game. You have to know what you're doing. But I can teach people and I can tell them what to do. And I will tell you this, I have one rule if I'm helping a state with any kind of legislative drive. There's nothing I hate worse. Forgive my French. I hope I'm not going to get in trouble for being a little off color here. But there's nothing I hate worse in the world than an asshole. An asshole is defined as a person who asks for your help and then tells you why you're wrong. If I'm wrong, if you don't respect what I have to say enough to engage in a meaningful dialogue and so that we can work things out, but rather you're just going to go do what you're going to do anyhow, please go do what you're going to do anyhow without me. I have so much to do and I'm so busy that, you know, if I can help, I'm always going to step up and help. You know, I was telling Tanya that my little boy said to me once, he said, Mom, I don't understand. He said, why you? He said, you were everything. You were the room parent. You were the, you know, you went on the field trips. You did the bake sales. He says, why did it have to be you? And I told him, I said, Stone, God needed a foot soldier. And I got recruited. So I believe that there's a reason for everything that happens in your life. And I believe that your mission in life is to figure out what is this hiccup in the road? What opportunity does it present? What am I supposed to learn from this? And then you take it and you do what you can to make a difference. And that's, so I believe there's a reason I got this disease. And I believe it was to teach, it was to change the law, and it was to try to counsel people and help them get access to medical care that they can't otherwise get. And so that's what I do. But I really don't need anybody to call me that already knows how to do it, because God bless, I'm not the last word online. There's so many people that do know what they're doing. You know, I just, I wish them the best.
It's kind of like the clinic in Switzerland. You know, if you're going to go there, do what they ask you to do. Don't tell them how to be there, to be the doctors.
That was the hardest lesson I had to learn. You know, he said, what do we know about you? He says, you know, either you came here for our help or go do it yourself. I said, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I got school.
Well, it's been such a pleasure. It's been such an honor. And I'm so grateful for everything that you're doing in this field. Cause like, you know, yeah, you know, you're defending the defenseless.
Yes. That access to care, that's a big one for me. You know, I testified in front of HHS, the working tick-borne disease working group. Every chance I get, I'm always out there advocating for access to care, because I see so many people who need help, who just don't have the ability. You know, a lot of the stuff isn't covered by insurance, and they can't even get in to find a doctor who will take them seriously. That breaks my heart. That's not right. That shouldn't be. And so as long as there's somebody out there that needs help, here I be. You know?
Yeah.
I love it. No, I'm beyond grateful for what you do. It's amazing. It's amazing.
And you for what you do.
Thank you. You know, we've talked a few times before, and it's just, I think that when we go through a battle like Lyme, we just can't let it go for vain. Like, I learned so much along my journey about health, our body, the doctors, what they do, what they don't do. You know, we had to share it with somebody. We had to make a purpose behind why we got sick. And so many people are doing that, and you are taking it to the next level. And I love it.
You know, when I said in the title, you either get bitter or you get better. I've had people say to me, you know, I would love to do stuff like you do, but I'm too sick. And believe me, when I started, I was that sick. But I have seen people so completely and thoroughly disabled who have done amazing things. One woman put on a demonstration at the New York Times, and myself and two other people, we were allowed to go up and talk to the science editor about why they don't cover articles regarding Lyme disease. And we also, and she was completely bedridden. I mean, she's so sick. God bless her. That's what she, you know, she was able to put on this whole huge demonstration. Melissa Bell, when she was sick, she came up with the Lyme disease challenge. These are people that worked from their bed and did these amazing things, absolutely amazing things. They're my heroes. You know, these people who, regardless of, you know, how horrifically challenged they may be health-wise, they understand the gift and the purpose of being able to effectuate change and help others. And what you give, you get back tenfold. You really do.
Wow. I think we could talk to you for hours. It's been amazing. Thank you so much for sharing your journey, your treatment in Switzerland. And we'll definitely put the name of the clinic in your title if you'd like to.
Great.
and people know how to reach out to you. I hope you don't get blown up over this one. You've got all these people reaching out and they want to bring the whole kitchen sink.
See, well, with regard to the clinic in Switzerland, they're so gracious, these people. They've been kind enough that the people from the US who've wanted to go over, that's a big investment. So, you know, people want to know what they're getting into. And they do, for me, if you reach out to me, they will give you a consultation over the phone at no charge. And a lot of the doctors, I've introduced doctors to them that have gone over actually and trained with them. And that's wonderful, because then the doctors come back and they can, you know, help the patients on the stateside when they return. So they're very, very gracious people. And so if anybody's interested in that, they can feel free to call me as well.
Wonderful.
Well, thank you so much, Susan. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure meeting you.
Pleasure.
You too. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
The information in this podcast is for educational purposes only and is not designed to diagnose or treat any disease. I hope this podcast impacted you as it did me. Please subscribe so that you can be notified when new episodes are released. There are some excellent shows coming up that you do not want to miss. If you're enjoying these podcasts, please take a moment to write a review, and please don't keep this information to yourself. Share them with your family and friends. You never know what piece of information that will transform their lives. For past episodes and powerful information on how to conquer Lyme, go to integrativelymesolutions.com, and an additional powerful resource, limestream.com. For Lyme support and group discussions, join Tanya on Facebook at Lyme Conquerors Mentoring Lyme Warriors. If you'd like to know more about the cutting-edge integrative Lyme therapies my center offers, please visit thecarlfeldcenter.com. Thank you for spending this time with us, and I hope to see you at our next episode of Integrative Lyme Solutions with Dr. Carlfeld.